Welcome to the Black Op Podcast. This podcast offers our community a dual perspective of Black people who serve our community as law enforcement officers through thoughtful discussion, debate, and articulation of facts with some reasonable opinion. Our communities are struggling to coexist, and this podcast serves as a bridge to help reconcile these two communities. Be sure to like, subscribe, and follow, and keep up with our page on Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, and Twitter.
King of the class, man. Take your crown, King. Check one, two. Welcome back to the Blackout Podcast. I'm your host, C-Dub. That tune is called Backstage Pass from Spano, Monte Booker, and the Drums. This is not your radio station. It's just a little testing, a little something different. I'm trying out some new things for the new year. See how it sounds, see how long it lasts. Get the energy right. So, welcome. Thank y'all for joining us. This has been a good year and a busy year. If you haven't noticed, by the way, Backstage Pass, because listen to this podcast, you kind of get a behind the scenes feel for what's going on in law enforcement and what to expect. Get some questions asked, get some questions answered. But again, thank y'all for joining me. Thank y'all for being with me. Y'all could have been anywhere else in the world, which y'all are here with me. We're going to delve into some topics dealing with the riots and the charges of attacks by mob on the U.S. Capitol building today. We all are probably shocked and have questions and are looking forward to the next steps and unifying and healing in our country. But that, of course, comes after the accountability that needs to be had. And shout out to my brothers in blue for fighting the good fight, holding it down, literally fighting with your hands, with your weapons, with your items on your duty belt, with your voice, with your sound tactics. Even though you were undermanned and underprepared and overwhelmed, and what hindsight, well, and what intel, according to news, has provided and said that was going to happen. We knew this event was going to happen. We knew they were going to attempt to besiege the U.S. Capitol building in an attempt to stop the certification votes from happening. But I don't want to focus too much on the politics of it as much as I want to focus on the law enforcement aspect of it. So, again, thank y'all for joining me. Make sure you like the page and subscribe to the YouTube page and follow the Instagram handle and the Twitter. Share it and help us help you. If you have any ideas or anything you want to talk about, let me know. I'd be more than happy to put that out there so that way you can have a better perspective on law enforcement. If law enforcement, some of my law enforcement buddies have questions, let me know and we can bring them to the table as well. I'll have you on the show. I don't mind. You know what I mean? So let's get this party rolling.
Some guys started getting a hold of my gun and they were screaming out, kill him with his own gun. At that point, it was just like self-preservation. How do I survive this situation? And I thought about, using deadly force. I thought about shooting people. And then I just came to the conclusion that, you know, if I was to do that, you know, I might get a few, but I'm not going to take everybody, and they'll probably take my gun away from me, and that would definitely give them the justification that they were looking for to kill me if they already didn't have made that up in their minds. So the other option I thought of was, you know, try to appeal to somebody's humanity. And I just remember yelling out that I have kids, and it seemed to work. Some people in the crowd started to encircle me and try to offer me some level of protection. A lot of people have asked me, you know, my thoughts on the individuals in the crowd that, you know, that helped me or tried to offer some assistance. And I think kind of the conclusion I've come to is like, you know, thank you, but f*** you for being there.
Wow. Yeah, so, I mean, let's just delve into this situation a little bit. This guy is holding the fort outside of the Capitol building. He is using less lethal means of defending himself and defending the building from the intruders, the rioters. They pull him out. They drag him down the steps. They're hitting him. They're beating him. People are yelling out, kill him with his own gun, shoot him with his own gun. That is the epitome of your worst nightmare. So the reason why I want to bring that up is most people understand the significance and the, you know, the finality of that moment. But what I want to point out is what would have been different if they'd have been prepared? Like how would that actually went? We've all seen how they responded when the news of the Black Lives Matter protest was, when I say they, the law enforcement professionals of the, and the U.S. Capitol and everybody involved up in D.C., how they prepare for the Black Lives Matter march, because they were concerned about the threats. Well, they had warnings about this riot that was going to occur. But they did not take the appropriate steps, most likely because implicit bias will tell us that we don't perceive people that we relate to as much of a threat. Or you can say that there's some type of inside job. There's more investigation to be had. We'll find out when we find out. But what I will say is that in that situation, you just can't pull out your gun and start shooting at people. I mean, you need to really have a line in front of you that's protecting you. You need to have a line that's behind that line that is there to grab people and take them into custody. You need to have a group of people that's going to be able to take into custody multiple people and direct them back to a transport or a holding cell where they then can be arraigned by another group of people and booked and charged appropriately. And all you have is U.S. Capitol Police asking for help from D.C. Metro, who don't even have jurisdiction on that property. I'm sure there's some type of mutual aid agreement where, you know, if a D.C. Metro officer needs to testify, needs to charge someone, he will write a witness statement. And then that Capitol Police officer in front of a federal judge will sign off on a criminal complaint. And that D.C. Metro officer would pretty much be like a citizen, a regular citizen, but a professional expert in the field of law enforcement. And the Capitol Police officer will be someone who is taking a report, in a sense. So it can happen. You can take out the charges. But they were wholly unprepared. And they were experiencing these things. They were experiencing these matters from people who were also in law enforcement, from people who were also and the military, people who serve in the enforcement area of law. So we're talking about, you know, having not just the riot shields, but having the gas mask and the face mask. And he was right. If he would have used that gun, he would have gave them reason to shoot him, which they really weren't searching for a need to kill someone. They were just looking for a reason. And, that was crazy. Now, this is the story of the guy that was caught between the door, between the mob and the police officers holding the riot shields.
Grabbing and crushing D.C. Metro police officer Daniel Hodges by a door. There's a guy ripping my mask off, and he was able to rip away my baton and beat me with it. And, he was practically foaming at the mouth. So just these people were true believers in the worst way. When things were looking dire, obviously I was calling out for all I was worth, and an officer behind me was able to give me enough room to pull me out of there, and they brought me to the rear, so I was able to extricate myself.
Hodges miraculously.
Wow. This kid is, first of all, that's courtesy of the CNN. They spoke to CNN and gave their testimonies. I personally believe, that is the difference there. That's the testimony, the description of these officers is the most apolitical thing that could happen in this moment. These are police officers. These are individuals that relate to all demographics in America. And these aren't politicians. These aren't the media trying to narrate or spin something. These are people who were literally on the ground, literally involved, victims and bystanders of an insurrection, of a violent attack by a mob. I feel like those are the stories that need to come to the forefront. And we need more of those stories. We need more of those officers who testify, who are in that moment to testify, to speak out and describe their experiences. Because if you want to talk about keeping someone accountable and getting the truth out, getting the facts out, so that way we can eventually start to heal down the road, that's what's going to have to happen. Because people need to know that if you're going to carry a flag that says Blue Lives Matter, but then attack someone and hit someone with a flag and then threaten to kill someone who's wearing a uniform, you're carrying that flag in vain. You don't support police officers. And I don't even use the phrase Blue Lives Matter, honestly. But the fact of the matter is that if you claim to support police officers and law enforcement in the law enforcement community, then or the sheriff, deputies, or anybody in the law, corrections officers or whatever, you cannot kiss somebody with a flag. That's just crazy. So I think that and this guy was crushing, stuck in between a door, and concern for his life.
Kind of dissonance, and the zealotry of these people is unreal. They were waving the thin blue line flag and telling us, we're not your enemies while they were attacking us, and kill one of us. Some of them felt like that we would be quick. Some of them felt like we would be fast friends because so many of them have been vocal, or at least virtue signaling, their support for the police over the past year. They say things like, we've been supporting you through all this Black Lives Matter stuff. You should have our back. And they felt like entitled. They felt like they would just walk up there and tell us that they're here to take back Congress, and we would agree with them, and we'd walk in hand and just take over the nation. But obviously, that was not the case, and it will never be the case.
He said, you should support us because we've been supporting you through all the Black Lives Matter stuff. So we by now understand and know that the Second Amendment gives us the right to form militias and with that bear arms. And in a sense, states utilize that freedom to authorize a city and a state to hire a public servant through their local municipalities, through their local governments, to hire police officers who, in a sense, are the public's militia. And I know I use that in the loosest sense of the word or the words. And when the public has a police, the public is able to impose their philosophy or political ideologies. They're able to impose their culture, their way of living, by transforming those things into law and then having police enforce those things on their behalf. It is my opinion, my humble opinion, that I think that police reform is probably playing a significant portion or playing a significant role in the cause or the reason for the uprooting and increase in these militias, because policing is starting to look different. Policing is starting to be held accountable and differently, and people are in communities are starting to expect things differently. You know, the Black community has always seen a different style of policing than the white community or the wealthier community. And because of technology, people are starting to realize that there are some, even though policing is full of honorable people, there have been some dishonorable things that occurred by some really dishonorable people in policing. And now that that has occurred, now that they see that their principles, their opinions about the way the world should be are not enforced by police, it's like now they want to take up their own enforcement of it. And they want other current police officers to let them through because they need to adopt their philosophy, which is the way they feel like it's always should have been, always been, is their government. It doesn't belong to anybody else. And of course, we know that race has a significant role in how they feel, you know, how these individuals may feel like, you know, their country is theirs. And they may feel like more like a minority today than they did in the past. And therefore, they feel like they need to fight to take this government back, which is not new to U.S. history. We've always fought for control of our government, and even amongst ourselves. It's not our preferred way of doing things. But, of course, that is a part of our history. And I feel like the reason why these militia groups have been brought about is because now that policing is focusing more on being fair, focusing more on being dramatic pause, while policing is focusing more on equal rights towards Black communities, focusing more on police reform, focusing more on you see a lot more Black chiefs, a lot more Black executives. You see places like Atlanta and these huge, largely African-American metropolitan hubs starting to take control and input. You start seeing people vote in local and state elections and communicating with their city council members about what they want from their police department. You see southern states that typically are able to root out minority voting or overrule it, struggling to do that. So now there's this way of life being lost. Somebody's got to fight for it. And I don't know what's more unfortunate, the fact that somebody's willing to fight for something that they may, that most of us seem, feel, or believe is on the wrong side of history, or if they don't really care and they just want their way because they want their way. All right, so let's just transition a little bit. So I wanted to start off with that article because I felt like with that video audio, because it just sounded really good and it just gives a perspective. But I want to bring up a BuzzFeed article, excuse me. Two Black police officers describe the racist attacks they face as they protected the Capitol building. Now, if the first segment, the first two officers that you heard were white males and they were just met by CNN. Now, these two Black officers described that the morning of the incident, they were told by their upper management that it was just any other regular protest. You know, like, I don't know. And I say regular because not out of disrespect, but as a regular as in like nonviolent. So they thought it might have been a regular, you know, pro-life, pro-choice, or, you know, PETA kind of thing, and just stand by and be ready. But this officer got a text message from his friend at 9 a.m. in the morning that told him the Proud Boys said that they're coming, and they're coming to breach the Capitol. Meanwhile, the upper management is not even there that day. So out of all the days that your upper management is not present, it is when you are going to have a hearing in the U.S. Capitol where the president-elect is going to be confirmed by the confirmed by the Electoral College as the next president of the United States, knowing that there is a fight against that, and you're going to choose to be off that day. That's just crazy to me. And so they wound up not only understaffed, but without leadership in that moment. So this guy is saying that these people were here, and of course they're calling them the N-word because that's part of these rioters' MO. I guess that's their thing. And then he says that they were very well prepared. I mean, despite, you know, how it looked like a rally or a party, he describes how they were very organized and how they were very ready to overtake the building and capture and or kill the people that were inside this building. He said they actually fought them off for 2 hours, even though some officers just let them walk in, as we see on video. They were fighting for 2 hours to keep them out of that building. He said they were heavily trained. They had radios, two-way communicators, earpieces. They had bear spray and flashbangs. They had strategically placed IEDs, pipe bombs in two different locations, which, of course, you know, if to the untrained eye, that's just like, okay, that's very strategic. You're going to force somebody one way, you're going to force them another way. That's very dangerous. He even goes on to describe how they, when he came face to face with officers, they flashed their badges and said, hey, you know, let us through. Hey, we're doing this for you. Assuming that he was going to help them out, you know, like it's a really good article. So if you guys have an opportunity to read it, I mean, it goes on to say how when they got back going with the electoral vote confirmation, he just broke down crying in the rotunda, frustrated, feeling like the group was just a racist mob of terrorists. And he goes on to say that, you know, he felt like that his colleagues who were taking selfies and letting people in, or even the ones who were fighting against the mob, were the same ones who voted for the person who incited the insurrection, which is what that person is impeached for. So it's, law enforcement is predominantly white male profession. And I don't know if that'll change, but I do know that there has been an increase in minorities in policing for the sake of wanting to make their communities better, make their communities feel like they were there to be guardians of the community and not so much vigilantes and John Waynes of the community. And so that's admirable. We want that. We want people to sign up for that. And I think what you see is that the political divide makes its way into departments. And so there is this thing there where you're better off not talking about politics because you don't know what's going to offend somebody. But at the same time, how do you work with someone who you know may support the idea, the culture, the philosophy that may be against your own well-being? And it's not just in policing, of course, but it's just a different context in policing because you still rely on each other to keep each other safe. You still rely, you got to have my back. I need to make sure that you're going to help me out when I have to get physical or when I have to engage and make sure this citizen in this moment in this place is safe and somebody's taken into custody. You need me to be able to do that for you. So fortunately, in those environments, political issues are resolved and put away. So that way, and there's actually more of a brotherhood understanding amongst people like that because of those extreme circumstances, like we often see among service members, and the military. However, there is this concept of like, man, like, what team are these people on? It reminds me of the Civil War I had a teacher, I ain't gonna say her name because, you know, I don't say her name. But what I'll say is that she was Dixie Pride. She was South, and she moved, and she was bold, and she made sure she gave multiple accounts of a story about the Civil War, and particularly a reference to what I'm talking about here. She talked about how families in the Confederacy often were fighting against each other because you had the people who were hardcore, you know, wanting to separate, wanting that culture, that way of life. And you had people who kind of felt like it's not necessarily the way we want to have a peaceful society. We want to have a peaceful society. We want to have a peaceful transfer of power. We want to be able to vote. We want our family and our kids to live in a safe environment. And we want to have this rule of law in place, regardless of where it comes from. And so these guys, who their cousins, who may like, just like today's time, they may believe that, you know, this election was rigged or something. But they may not be in this. They may be in the same political party, but they may just be on two opposite spectrums of that party, where those people end up warring against each other and killing each other. Brothers, family, sisters. And that's what it sounds like today. And so it's like, and officers that I know, sheriff deputies that I know, are also in that same situation where they are still part of a particular party, but they don't believe it as much as maybe their cousin does or their relative does. And they don't want to be seen as violent and irrational, as criminal and nefarious as their cousin is. Where they do have some political leanings that help, that relate to their cousin outside of their familiar relationship. So long story short is that policing is this microcosm of all these ideals together, where people are figuring out how to interact with each other, and they're going through these emotional highs and lows, and now they are being told to support and look after the person that is causing me harm. And it's one thing when when you're in your own part of the precinct and I'm in my own part of the precinct and it's just whatever. It's another thing when I'm getting punched in the face. You know what I mean? And so I can only imagine the psychological, you know, issues. And we've did a podcast on it with Dr. Marlena Webster. So check us out. That talks about the mental health aspects on the Black community and on police officers who struggle in these moments. So all right, so in closing, guys, I want to talk about a modern day hero that we don't always get to recognize the heroes, and I think this is a good idea and a good chance to do so. If you've not heard by now, my modern day hero is Capitol Police Officer Eugene Goodman. Eugene is the individual that many of us saw the day of, who's like had his hand on his gun initially and then put out his baton and then walked away and like ran up the stairs and then turned again and then ran up the stairs again while you could see him on his radio calling for help. And, you know, turns again. He finally gets in the hallway where he gets the more backup. And Eugene is Officer Goodman, because I don't really know him. Officer Goodman is, he's in that moment. Us in law enforcement understand what he's doing as far as like slowly holding the crowd back, providing enough resistance, but giving way till he gets to his backup. Some people were wondering, like, well, why didn't he just, you know, start shooting? It's like, well, you're not going to kill everybody in that crowd, and that's going to give them reason to kill you. And he pulls out a baton as an extra means of protection, as an extra weapon. And the crowd is very, you know, they didn't show any arms themselves, and they were trying to advance. So they were, you know, very intentional how they were presenting themselves to him as well, and trying not to give him the option as well to use lethal force. And they were advancing on him. And like I said earlier, in an ideal situation, you're going to have a numbers advantage and organization advantage that would allow you to make a mass arrest. But that didn't happen in that moment. But The genius of Officer Goodman is him glancing down the hall to see the Senate chamber doors open, where apparently it is reported that they wanted to attack the vice president. And so he sees that and he pushes the guy on his shoulder to kind of like get his attention to make him want to kind of be more aggressive and follow him some more, like he's trying to push him back or something. And, you know, according to the Washington Post, the vice president was like 100 feet away at that point. So I want to say thank you to Officer Eugene Goodman. You know, your service has helped the stability of this country, as well as the service of the D.C. Metro Police and the U.S. Capitol Police. So with that being said, I am C-Dub. Thank y'all for joining me. Check on us again. We're going to have some different things coming up in the future. I think I'm going to have a debate podcast about different police topics, get some different perspectives on here. So keep us locked, keep us subscribed. So, and do the notification thingy. So when we do post, you can, be made aware and check us out. Anyway, God bless and peace. Stop.